Museum of East Texas, May 20th, 2001.
It continues to property. And for many, many years, downtown Lefton was the center of that business, so I can. And as a young lad, I was always glad to go downtown with my dad and family on Saturday nights. Now, it's hard to believe that downtown Lefton on Saturday night was a very, very busy place. Hundreds and hundreds of people would be downtown on Saturday night. The stores, most all the stores, stayed open till 9 o'clock.
Everybody
okay.
Stayed up
until 10. What now?
Everybody stayed up
until 10. Rachel and I knew you would get in. Both of them stayed up until 9, but Perry stayed up until 10. So, back to that last night. Okay, so then, it's hard to believe that all the traffic now between Texarkana and Houston passed right through downtown Lefton. One lane south, one lane north. That was it. Every car that moved between Texarkana and Houston went right through downtown Lefton. And that was a sight to see also. The traffic would be, took a long time to get to Lefton back in those days. Also, by some, I don't know if this was planned or not, but Lefton by the time 1940 had got turned around here, had several buildings that were classic Art Deco buildings. And I don't know if that was planned or it just happened to be that was the way the architecture style happened at that time. But if you look at the Pines Theater building, and the building where Firehouse Charlie's is, those are two of the outstanding examples of Art Deco that period. Those, what's known as the high school building, which is on Gay Street now, it's, some businesses bought that. It was a Lefton Junior High for many years. That school building is out and out classic Art Deco, and I just think Lefton is fortunate to still have some of those buildings around, and I'm glad to see that they're moving towards the preservation of some of those buildings. Then I want to move on to, George Henderson said just a few minutes ago that alluded to the early days of Lufkin. And my lead line on the part was, in its early days, Lufkin was a wild and woolly town. In fact, passengers on the AC and WT Railroad were warned by conductors that they were taking their lives in their own hands as they got off the train at Lufkin. And maybe that's, the Monitor Boys may have had something to do with that. Now, no doubt that some of the violence was fueled by Lufkin's many saloons. Five saloons were identifiable in 1905 and 12 by 1910. When the railroad people developed Lufkin, they wisely donated several lots for churches. Two of them I'm acquainted with was the First Methodist Church, where their building was, and before they moved out on Denman Avenue there. They were over on 2nd Street. And then the First Baptist was on Fremont and 1st Street. The churches were organized, the Lefton churches were organized shortly after the town became, the lots were sold and the town began to develop. But the saloons got the edge on the churches right off the get-go. And it took years for them to catch up. So we had five saloons we know of in Lefton by 1905. We know of 12 by 1910. And the owners read like who's who of Lufkin at the time was Newsom, Brookshire, Markle, Collins, Weaver, and Chancy. I didn't name the rest of them. But the who's who was listed as Newsom, Brookshire, Marcus, Collins, and Weaver. They were the who's who of Lufkin at that time. You notice there that some Newsom still live here. There's some Marcus descendants live here, but only the Brookshires have a business identity in Lufkin today. And it's far different than Tom's Brookshire Saloon, which is on Lufkin Avenue. And Tom Brookshire Saloon has unique because it had most of the years every business had a monkey inside the saloon, and people wondered just really who the monkeys were in that saloon, of course. Legend has it that at one time or other there was 14 saloons in Lufkin. Now, I can't identify 14 saloons all at one time, but I'm not going to argue with that. You know, legend is just a story that's been told over and over, which just sounds like the truth. That's what legend is. By 1910, the liquor prohibition movement had been steadily gaining ground in most Texas communities, which were operating under state, local, option law. But Lufkin remained solidly wet. but the dry forces were closing the gap. Lufkin voted dry in 1950. And I'm glad to know, George, that you're noted for this by that. What church was it?
Oh, she was Methodist, well, for Pete's sake.
I knew you were, but I didn't know it. If I'd thought about it, I might have known it. Okay. Well, they were leading the Methodist, and Brother Cole in the First Baptist Church. They were the ones who really got that ball rolling, you know.
Well, when you look at that photo that they got with all the signs, and you recognize what the population of Lufkin was at that time, it wasn't any question in my mind it's going to go dry.
Well, it did, and it did in 1915. And so Lufkin saloons closed their doors forever in 1915. Okay. All the United States went dry when the Volstead Act went into effect in 1919. But by the time that happened, there was only 12 counties in Texas that had municipalities with that were wet. All the other Texas, except places in 12 counties in Texas, had already gone dry by 1919. Prohibition was repealed in 1933, but it never did open up those closed saloon doors that were closed in 1915. But there were some beer distributors here, and there were some places in Angelina County that you could buy at least beer after 1933. But that was shut down in Angelina County when they voted dry again for the second time in 35 or 37. So at every election since, Lufkinites have voted dry and continues to drink well.
Thank you, Woody. And hopefully we're going to get to some opportunities for audience participation here on some of these old saloon stories or other stories that we'll get to. But right now, I'm going to ask Dr. Thames to tell us a little bit about the medical community.
Let me add my welcome. Also, they wanted to come out here and be involved in such a type of enterprise as this. But the practice of medicine in East Texas has evolved tremendously. And I've been blessed that I got to live through the best part of it. The Lord let me come on the scene when it was really beginning to explode. And it's unreal the way it really has evolved. But in the early days, well, East Lufkin was in East Texas all the way, of course. I mean, East Texas was always here, Lufkin wasn't here, but there were a few hardy souls that lived in this area. And they lived with the Indians. And they had the doctors, they did their own doctrine, and they made extracts of tea, and bark, and roots, and everything else, and made poultices and salves and stuff. And they got by, but the life expectancy was not quite as good as it is today. And they began to kind of, they farmed and lived, but they got the grouping together, and then they had doctors begin to come in. How well they were trained was kind of questionable, but some people who said they were doctors that did get them some medical stuff, some laxatives, some calomel and stuff. They'd play doctor and they'd could live in their house, most of them, but nobody came to see them much unless it was an emergency they couldn't drag them in. But they'd get to go see them at the house. They'd go on a horse or they'd ride on a buggy. And they delivered the service as best they could. They had all sorts of diseases just like we have now. They didn't have anything to treat them, but they had about five or six different drugs that they carried. It maybe worked a little bit, and sometimes they may have sicker, but when they got feeling better, they really thought the doctor done some good. But they be called to deliver babies when the family couldn't deliver, and they'd always be in trouble. The doctor had a hard time delivering a lot of the babies. It's a little too gruesome, really, to kind of go into, I guess, but they used to, you know, ladies couldn't have their baby, and they would have to destroy the child, take it out piece by piece, and that's kind of, I won't go into that any further, but they had a hard time anyway. But then they get a kind of group together, closer together, and make some little town. Homer got to be a pretty good town. And y'all are a little bit library, and they came to pull out issues of the Homer Banner. They had a newspaper. The doctors all advertised in the newspaper back in those days, down on the front page, down on the side, and Dr. So-and-so, Dr. So-and-so, told what they specialized in, Anson Ball, their babies or whatever they did, and fever and various things. But it's very interesting to look at. I don't know whether they'll look at it anymore. And when I checked that back some years back, they were, the fever was already so frail and so attenuated that they didn't want me to feel it. And I shouldn't have, I guess, but I did read it. But yeah, I think they put some lamination somewhere now. But it really is interesting. Lufkin came on the scene as a result of the railroad, but the railroad did something else too. The railroad opened up this whole area into logging. And a little sawmill town, just from everywhere, they had a town called Lock, Ivy, Eudora, Silver Springs, Emporia, Camp Nancy, boy, there was a bunch of them. Claude, Clawson, that Kelpis, that Dieball, they had many big sawmills. And each one of those sawmills had some accidents and personal things and other. Each one of them had a sawmill. They all had an office. The doctors were in all these sawmills all around the whole county. And then the logging began to kind of play out. And around the turn of the century, and the people trying to move to town, they came all kind of congregated in Lufkin. And it was a pretty loose organization then, and, but about 1904, 1906, they established the doctors that were there at that time. They got together and they created the Engineering County Medical Society. Now, the Texas Medical Association had been established back in 1845 and so, and this has been there a long time. But the National Academy of Medical Society established, it had about 8 or 10 people that I haven't here, but I can't bring them to mind right now. But that established it. And they had the one of the prominent leaders of the medical community was Dr. Matt Denman. And then he was on the first car in the county, and he got killed in a railroad train getting up here. But he built the first hospital in Lufkin. Had the first x-ray machine. Actually, that his thing was for, I think it was there for the first autopsy was done in East Texas. But it evolved, and the next big thing was the war came along. A lot of people went to war, and a lot of them came back from World War II, and they started. And Engineer County Hospital was built in 1919, I think it was. And that hospital was built on the corner there at Bannon and Frank Street, where it's a big busy intersection now. The hospital followed in just into a nursing home. But at that time, and actually when I started practicing medicine here in 1946, 48, Frank Street stopped right there. That was in there. And there's this field out there where Memorial is now. And Dirt Street then went back on up and connected it with Ellis Street. And Ellis Street was the way out of town. And you had to go out of Ellis Street to go out in 94. But then, along about the end of 1940s, when World War II was over, and a bunch of them were coming back from service. And I had just gotten out of school, and I came here in 48. And the only specialists in town were three people who had limited their practice to eye, ear, nose, and throat. Now, I know Dr. Eastep. He had been a family practitioner in Paris, and he moved to Lufkin, and just limited his practice to ear, nose, and throat, eye, ear, nose, and throat. Dr. Dillon was here, and he had, I think he had a little bit of training in ear, nose, and throat. Dr. Percy here, who's had a little training in eye, ear, nose, and throat. And that's the only specialist we have in town. Oh, my
time.
No,
you got another 4 minutes, Doc.
Best parts come in, but then they started having specialists start coming to town. Dr. Froome Shepherd came in. I started in July of 48. He came in about October, November 48. And then the next year, Dr. Arnett came in urology. And then Dr. Orban came as surgeon. Dr. Mitchell came in OBGYN. And Dr. Peyton Demon came as an internist. And then the floodgates, and Dr. One thing's in there too. Dr. Pruitt came as a pathologist. And then the old county hospital, well, they never kept any kind of records except just the temperature so forth. So they were keeping the history of the physical, anything, but nothing like that written on the chart. No profit charts were ever made. And in surgery, well, they took out some, they threw it away. They didn't ever have it examined. That wasn't looked at. And if somebody just took out the appendix, and if that, the doctor would tell them it was a terrible appendix, and there wasn't anything wrong with it. It was pretty crude. That was the way it was. I started. I lived this, folks. I know. All these years it was developing, well, I got in right at this beginning to change, because we didn't have any, when I started practicing medicine, we didn't have a single, we had, well, we had one thing, but we didn't really have a drug to treat high blood pressure. I bet nearly all of you take some kind of high blood pressure. There's about 100 kinds now. But we used phenobarbital. That was a treatment for high blood pressure in 1948. And we didn't have any kind of, penicillin started just about that same time. We had some sulfa drug, and I won't tell that one, but we had, pretty soon after the penicillin came out, they came out with streptomycin to treat tuberculosis particularly, and they found out they were giving it like water and it'd make you deaf if you took too much of it, so they had to slow back on that, and they came out with that. Drug called oreomycin and acromycin, and then the mycin is just the floodgates open, and there's no telling how many of them are involved, and then another echelon will come in, and another one, another one. The bugs are smarter than you think. They get the word that those things don't kill them, you know, and we use them indiscriminately, the doctors have, mostly from peer pressure, perpetually from the patients. The patients them come in demanding to give them something, and most of them find that. Most antibiotics are not very harmful to you, except if you give them too much, too often will about get used to them. So that's fine. Penicillin is still a good drug in certain cases, but you can't use it. It won't kill a lot of bugs. It used to kill real good. Another thing I bring out, when I came to Lufkin, I think there was 14 doctors in Lufkin at the time, and we all just treated everything that came in. So the specialists began to come in, and as we got specialists coming in, we got to doing a lot better job at the hospitals. We got the horses, particularly when the memorial was opened up in 1949, we organized it a lot better than ever had any organization at the county hospital. And we had to have histories and physicals and so forth, and every specimen that was taken out of surgery had to go to a pathologist. And we loved the cancer center after a fashion, and with a cobalt machine, which was one of the few in Texas that now was the latest thing in treatment of cancer. And Mr. Kirk arranged to have, and Mr. Calder together, and then arranged to have one placed in Memorial Hospital. And that was a big thing for a while, but then they found better things to treat it with. And then chemotherapy came in, oncologists came in. I think it's about 200 doctors now in Lufkin. They come and go, kind of, you know, and half of them come in, I wouldn't recognize them. Okay, good. I can talk all night.
Hopefully we're going to give you plenty of opportunity to have a lot of questions here in the meantime. But, you know, and you tell, WD has enjoyed living here, and I think all of us have. Some of us have been here and never left. Odessa, on my right here, got to leave town and figured she didn't need to stay gone very long, and it wasn't very long. It was fun for her, I know, to have found out how the other half lives and need to come back home. Odessa, we'd love to hear from you.
Thank you so very much. I guess I start off in the red at the very beginning, because I noticed Mr. Newton said she'll talk about education and come on the right. And I looked at my notes, I said, my Lord, I have gone all over Lufkin to talk about blacks in this community. But I am going to turn my paper around and talk on education first. And then I do want to mention some of the things that I know about Lufkin. My parents moved here when I was a baby, and that was in 1924. So I should know quite a bit about this community. The first group for blacks was the Lufkin Ward School. And that was before 1923. That school was located on Chestnut Street. The principal was an N.T. Brand, and they knew him. And they had four teachers. Annie Pencil, whose father was Henry Parson Henry, who was a dispatcher for Southern Pacific Railroad. Didn't have any phones. So he walked and notified the brakesman as to the time they were to carry a train from Lufkin to Shreveport, or from Shreveport, I mean from Lufkin to Houston. Gladys Simpson is one of our early teachers. Melinda Garrett, and I'm going to talk to you in more detail after. And there are also, Ms. Paula Williams is one teacher. Now, after 1923, in fact, Dunbar was built in 1924 on Leach Street. This land was given to the two districts by Melinda Garrett and her husband, Mark Garrett. She was a dear person who believed in caring for and seeing that children would have an opportunity. Even I was told and read something about this that Kelvin went to the sixth grade, and she would let girls come in and live in her home during the week in order to go to Lucky Ward to school. They would come in and stay Monday through Friday and go back to Kelvin to be with their family on the weekend. So she wanted the black children in Lucky to have a real chance for education. So she and her husband donated the land that Dunbar on Leach Street, that's the first piece, was built. 1924, W.H. Brandon, and I was fortunate to go to school under him all the way through my grade school and high school. You know, in those days, you're so young, if you started off in what we call a primer, and then you went on up to the 11th grade, and finally the 12th. Dunbar started with the printer and went up to 10th grade. That was in 1924. Then in 1930, the 11th grade was added. I did a study of all the classes at Dunbar from the first graduating class, which was 1929, up to 1934. There was no graduating class at Dunbar in 30 because the 11th grade was added. Some of the students in the class of 29 came back to school after graduation and completed their work in the 11th grade. Now, and in the fall of 1941, the 12th grade was added. When I finished high school, it was the 11th grade, but the class behind me went to the 12th grade. A grade was not added. They deleted primer and started with first grade through 12th grade. Let me just mention W.H. Brandon, for which one of our students has been named. He was a dynamic educator. He believed in educating the whole child. Courses that were not offered in the curriculum, he taught them. He taught them geometry. And I have a copy of one of the books that he required earlier students, this student was in the class of 1934, to buy on higher mathematics. He wanted them to be exposed to all about learning. Another student in the class of 1931 said he taught them science from speech, rock, whatever he could find to really give them some knowledge of science. We also would have, and I'd like to mention that, what we call literary society on every other Friday afternoon. At this time, we had a chance to see the talent and ability of students. There was singing, there were speeches, and there would be a very good debate on a particular subject. The affirmative and the negative side, so that you would know the pros and cons of various topics. I could go on and on. He also taught grammar to the students, which was not in the curriculum. Now, when did the popularity of football come in? Well, it was I started school in 1929, so most of it I can remember. We had our first football team at Dunbar in the fall of 1932. Well, there were no lighted fields, so the boys played football on a Friday afternoon. We would walk from Dunbar on Leach Street across, it was Highway 3, 59 across to Jack's Drive Mill. Anybody know about that? And he had a baseball field over there. So that's where the football games were first played for Dunbar. The first coach was Develius Johnson from Houston. He was a graduate of Tuskegee Institute. And he stayed with Dunbar from 1932 to 1935. Then a George Spencer came to be coach in 1935 to 1936. Following that coach came C.L. Franklin, who some of you may remember, finally became principal of Garrett School. But C.L. Franklin came here in 1936, and in 1942, he was drafted into World War II. So he went to war and stayed until 45, and he came back and finished coaching until 1953. Then he was made principal of Garrett School. While he was away, a Willie Ray Smith served as principal. Some of you might recall his son if you were into pro football. Bubba Smith, that was Willie Ray Smith's son, and he served as coach from 1942 to 1945. And then after Franklin came back and worked until 53, the next coach was Elmer G. Reagan. And you remember him, I know, 1953 to 1970. There were some win and lose times. The most winning time, you know, came under Elmer G. Reagan. Other principals that have served, let me just mention the first grade of primer teacher was Mrs. W.H. Brandon. Her name was Olivia Brandon. And she taught me in the primer. I was left-handed, and I'm using it today, but she maybe I probably would not have. She made me learn to write with my right hand. But just as soon as I got out of her room, I went back to my left hand. I write on the blackboard now with my right hand and on paper with my left hand. But Miss Brandon died that summer, June 30th. Olivia Hackney, the two Olivias and I say, Olivia Hackney replaced her in 1930 and worked in the elementary department of Dunbar School. Also, she was my basketball coach at Dunbar. Then later, she became a principal. And as you know, Carver School was the first elementary black school built for blacks coming out of Dunbar. Carver was located in Rosebud across from Luskin Ice Company, Phillips, down in that area. After Carver was rebuilt, however, the school was named for Olivia Hackney. And that school is located at Lexington. Some other principals are here. Frank Harris served as a principal. Lacey Chimney, C.L. Franklin, as I mentioned. Otis Rose, Lacey Sam, and the person we have is R.L. Kirkendall, served as a principal. So we go all down the line. Dunbar was, there were seven men served as principal at Dunbar. And of course, I won't go ahead and give you years, but there were seven, from Brandon all the way down to Travis Carr. You might also remember Mr. E. E. Cleaver, who was a community-minded man. This is when he came and he really got the school involved in community activities. F.W. Thomas, who became principal in 1940, let's go back just a little bit. Professor Brandon, I was promoted to the 11th grade in May 1940, and he died in June 1940. 10 years different in the time that his wife died and taught me, and the time he died. So you see, the list goes on as far as from 1924 to 1970. Now, let me just mention a few other things that I had in my notes. And as you come back, you might ask me some other things that I might know. When we were talking about horses and buggies and getting around in wagons and all of that, it came to my mind who was the first, maybe not the first, but in the 20s, a blacksmith was a black man. His name was Finis Price. He was located on 3rd Street, and that may be an age, and you can't start 3rd Street. Just behind the present-day City Hall was Finis Price's blacksmith shop, because the horses had to have a shoe. So he was a really good worker for that. I also would like to mention the doctor pointed out here, we have a few black doctors here too. I'll make a mention of that too, if you don't mind my shadowing. I have a scar on my arm right now from that vaccination, you know, that you had to have when you started school. Well, the little old doctor that did that was Dr. D.F. Simmons. He was a very tiny man. He was old then. I don't know how old he was, but he was old. And I can always remember, we had our opening of schools in the First Baptist Church across from some of our schools. And he would always say, he was not a tall doctor, he would always say, the way he was nervous, "September feels like school." I always remember that. But he was an early doctor. He was back in the early 20s, and he was located on Chestnut Street. The next doctor was Dr. C.M. Stewart. Dr. Stewart was a native of Michigan, and he grew up and went off to Meharry Medical School, and he returned and started practicing in 1928 on Townsend. Townsend then was more or less just the alley, but he was there for Townsend and then at the Lincoln Street. He passed away in 1944, and then of course he was replaced by a Dr. S. E. Packer. Dr. Packer was with us from 1945 to 1958. His office was located on what is now Martin Luther King. I grew up on that street, and that's Lake Street. But nevertheless, he was located there in a building that the Finans, the C.A. Finans family built for us to have offices within that community. The next doctor was in my... following Dr. Packer, the Citizens Chamber of Commerce that visited to get us a doctor after Dr. Packer died, and we worked very hard to get one, and Dr. Allen answered our request and came to Lexington to serve as doctor. He came in 1959 and stayed with us, I guess, 94. I see him so much now, he seems like he's a doctor now. But you know Dr. Allen. His first office was on Lake Street, Martin Luther King, then on Lakeview, and finally on Ellis Street. We only had one other black dentist other than Dr. P. Ayer, and that was Dr. J. M. Martin. He started practicing in 1922, and he practiced until 1964. Let me say one other statement. Mrs. Garrett was 72 years old when she stopped teaching, and she didn't want to retire then. I wanted to add that, and you will find that teachers were real dedicated. They were mamas and papas for the black children, and certainly it was a joy to have gone to school to them and then later come out and serve as a teacher myself.
Thank you very much. I'm particularly pleased that you mentioned Professor Cleaver. Professor Cleaver was quite, he was the quintessential educator, and he just looked like it when he walked in. I felt very high of him, so we appreciate you recalling some of those folks. I warned you about Bob Bowman, and here he is.
You know, I George Henderson gave me a challenge. He said, talk about all the instruments in the county. And that is an enormous challenge. He's knowing full well that I would probably exceed the time. He has promised a horse with me. He's going to do that only because I'm the smallest and the youngest of the other panelists. So I think he's doing this in retribution for all the practical jokes I've put on. To really understand the history, the evolution of Anderson and Anderson County, you really have to go back to 1882. And that's when, during the summer of that year, a whistle blew top a locomotive for the very first time in Anderson County. It was heard for the very first time in the woods surrounding this little village that we call Lufkin. Lufkin at that time was not known as Lufkin. You know, the whistle, of course, announced from Houston east and west next to Lufkin, which had arrived here at the crossroads village called Denman Springs. And Denman Springs was named for two people, two families, the Colonel Lafayette Denman, who's an old Civil War veteran who was doing a lot of land, and his son, Dr. A.M. Denman, who, of course, on the telephone company and did all the other things that he did talk about. The arrival of the railroad led to the establishment of of this little town that we now call Lufkin, which was named for a Galveston merchant named Abraham P. Lufkin. He was a close friend and business partner of the railroad's owner, Paul Bremont of Galveston. Mr. Lufkin, somewhere in our history, we've always assumed that Lufkin was named for Edwin P. Lufkin, who's a railroad engineer. Back in 1976, when we celebrated our centennial, or 1986, in 1982, when we celebrated the centennial, we found that there was no such individual as Edwin P. Lufkin. We went to Roseburg Library in Galveston, looked all through the records, and looked at the railroad records and everything, and surely there was no such individual. So the only conclusion you can make is that Lufkin was named Abraham Lufkin, who incidentally died at Paul Bremont's house in Galveston. When Mr. Bremont finished his Houston to Shreveport line in 1885, Anderson County had a lot of other whistles, primarily sawmill whistles, built on top of sawmills that were here to take advantage of all the lumber and all the timber that was growing along the railroad. And the railroad really gave us the opportunity to ship out for the very first time lumber to places like Houston, Galveston, and Shreveport, and other towns. And sawmills just began to blossom like mushrooms all over East Texas. There were just hundreds and hundreds of small sawmills, including a number of them in this county. And one of the earliest major sawmills was Anderson County Lumber Company, which was founded in 1888 by three uniquely different families. There was Joseph Kurt, a German immigrant, Simon Henson, who was an Irish storekeeper, and Sam Wiener, who was a Jewish merchant. Now, you can't imagine three more different kinds of people that got together and founded that sawmill. Of all of the three people, probably Mr. Kurt was the most interesting of all. He had been a resident of Germany for a number of years, and as a young man, he grew up in a Prussian village. And with a bunch of student distance, he threw some rocks in the local police station window and decided remorsefully that he needed to get out of town. Well, his family put him in a pickle barrel, closed the top, put him on a ship bound for England. When he got to England, he took another ship, came to Galveston, worked in sawmills for a number of years, and finally wound up in the bargain with his children and boy, and finally got up to Lufkin. He bought in Lufkin, or in Kelt, is a very small sawmill from two individuals' names that are kind of intertwined with our history. One was Charles Lewis Kelty, and the other was James A. Ewing. They had a little sawmill on the Cottonville Railroad, and the two men had built the mill to produce cross ties for the railroad, but it was not a very successful sawmill. And that even after they sold out the curve, Mr. Ewing stayed on and managed to build his foreman. Before selling, Ewing and Kelty had what was apparently Lufkin's very first railroad. And it wasn't a railroad that we think of in the traditional sense. It was a crude log tram that consisted of 4x4 wooden rails, not iron rails, not steel rails, but wood rails that were cut from pine trees. And the railroad cars were hauled over the rails, usually by oxen and mules, and later by a little shake engine, or what they call a dinky engine. For decades, the Kurt and the Hendersons and the Wiener families exerted an enormous influence over this community. They built other sawmills, not just the Angelina County Lumber Company's sawmill, but they had sawmills reaching all the way up to Clarksville and Red River County, all the way over in Louisiana. They built foundries, they built a railroad, they built insurance companies, they built banks, movie theaters, television, radio stations, hospital, our first hotel, and much, much more. They really ran from it. Those of you who've been around a long time, you know just how much influence those three families had. Other sawmills were built about the same time, of course, of Southern Fine Lumber Company, which was founded in Diboll in 1894 by T.L. Taylor of Texarkana. There was also another mill that the Temple family had a large interest in. There was the Luckin Land and Lumber Company that was founded in 1897 by George Chevy, E.A. Frost, and T.L. Temple. The Luckin Land sawmill went out of business around 1930. Southern Fine Lumber Company in Diboll began to expand. Mr. Temple had pulled most interest back to Diboll, and that's widened far beyond Diboll, and today we know it as Temple Hamlet. Southern Fine Lumber Company owes its existence really to the purchase of timber lands that were bought in the 1890s from the heirs of Joseph Coates Diboll. Now, if you go to New Orleans today, you'll move around the downtown area, you'll find a town square there called Diboll Square, but in New Orleans they pronounced it as Diboll. As a result of our early sawmills, Angelina County, near the peak of the great sawmill lumber boom, shipped out more lumber than any county in East Texas, than any county in Texas for that matter. That was around the turn of the century. It's been said that lumber originated in Luckin and built much of Houston in the, between 1890 and 1920. In 1902, another major industry had its start. That year, the Kerr, Henderson, Wiener families again grew the resources and decided that East Texas needed a shop to repair sawmill machinery and logging locomotive. Luckin Foundry Machine Company was, of course, founded in 1902, and incidentally, will celebrate its centennial next year. And the company did very well with very remarkable quick services, tough products, and very reasonable prices. In 1905, W.C. Trout, who was a creative sawmill machinery seller from Wisconsin, moved to Luckin, took a position with the foundry, and began inventing new products for sawmills and new products for the oil fields. Mr. Trout's invention of the counterbalance pumping unit in the 1920s set a standard for the oil field industry and led to today's modern Luckin industry, which now sells products and pumping units and gears and trailers all around the world. Between the late 1830s and early 40s, a very aggressive industrial effort gave us additional employers and hundreds of new jobs. It's been said that Luckin probably has about three great places in history where it really boomed and became what it is today. One was that instant where the ladies marched in the street and closed down the sawmill. That changed the city dramatically because we began to build churches, we began to build better schools, the saloons were not there anymore. We didn't have to do something else for the time. And so we began to evolve into a more creative, imaginative, finely tuned community with all those amenities that we did not have before the saloons. The other era was that era between in the late 1930s and early 1940s when we created a bunch of new industries. At that time, we probably created about 2,000 new jobs just in that one area. That's been called our golden era of industrial expansion. During that era, Martin Wagon Company was acquired by Luckin Foundry and became its trailer plant. Texas Foundry was moved here to St. Louis. It became the first malleable iron foundry west of the Mississippi River. South of Paper Mills, of course, built a pioneer newsprint mill at what is now Paul Hurdy, and changed the whole complexion of the South's paper industry. Until then, nobody had ever made white paper from southern pines in the South. We made what is called brown paper, craft paper for shopping bags. But nobody had ever made white paper that you could print a newsprint on or that you could print a book on and things such as that. South had changed all that in 1940 when they made the first paper here. And it led to enormous diversification of the paper industry throughout the whole South. Now, one interesting story is that we always give credit to Southland to those Luckin families who built it, and that's rightly so. But a lot of credit goes, ironically, to some foreigners. One was the Canadians who came here in the late 1930s to run the paper mill. In the 1930s, when they built Southland, they could not find any experienced paper makers anywhere in the South. First of all, nobody had ever made white paper in the South, so all the paper makers were only experienced in making brown or craft paper. Second, at that time, in the 1930s, there was only one paper mill in Texas, and that was in Pasadena, and again, they were making brown paper. So so Mr. Kirk had to hire a bunch of Canadians from Canada. There were dozens of them that moved here with their families, came to Lumpkin, and they started up a Lumpkin mill, and they stayed there. And those families are still intertwined in our community. Most of them are French Canadians, so they brought a kind of a new culture to this community. The second group of people, again foreigners, that probably saved the mill's hide was during the war years. During those years, the mill had an enormous problem trying to find labor to cut trees in the woods. All the young men had been taken away to the war. There was nobody to cut trees and haul the corn to get into the mill. Of course, women couldn't do those jobs. It was too tough. So Mr. Kirk went to the mill, war production board, and he worked out a deal to hire prisoners of war, German prisoners of war, who were in various camps throughout East Texas, including two months. And those prisoners of war hauled all the pulpwood for the paper mill during the war years and probably kept it shut down. Again, during that era, there was another important plant built, and that was the Temple of White plant in Davao, which made brooms and handles for different purposes. In our industrial community of the past, we also had some industries that we've forgotten about. Tom Hemison made cigars in the early 1900s, including the Texador, the Commercial Club, Floaty Angelina, and the Little Doris, which my wife has figured out, which is the leading 5-cent cigar of that day. We also had a fruit farm and canning factory, which went out of business. Ironically, and its manager was shot to death in the bank vault of Lumpkin National Bank, which is a whole other story. Norris Fence Company, it was an unusual company. They used sawmill waste to make picket fences, and ironically became the country's leading producer for snow fences in the north. For some reason, the people in the north liked Norris fences, snow fences, so they used a lot of them in this area. And we built the Davao, the South's very first plant to make plywood from southern pine trees, a company that was owned jointly by the Temple family and U.S. Plywood. Unlike today, when most industries were owned by large